This is Jim Inkster. Coming today on the show, we will visit with Jerry Seppos. He's the dean of the LSU Manship School of Mass Communication, one of the most celebrated parts of the Old War School. And next week, the Manship School will celebrate the 100th anniversary of journalism at LSU, and some luminaries from journalism such as Carl Bernstein will be headed to LSU in the coming days, and we'll talk with Jerry Seppos about that. Also talk with him about what's happening in our world in the way of media. And we'll hear from Tim Muffett, the conductor of the Baton Rouge Symphony, opening night tomorrow night, as the symphony begins its 65th season and the 15th year with Tim Muffett as the conductor. Now the news on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge, 297-5633 or 877-217-5757, inkstershow@wrkf.org if you'd like to reach us online. We start with Jerry Seppos. He is the dean of the Manship School of Mass Communication and a man who has spent his career in journalism in places all over this great land. Previously, he was the dean and professor at the University of Nevada, Reno. Good morning, Dean Seppos.
Good morning, Jim. Thanks for having me.
And 100 years of journalism at LSU will be celebrated next week in a very big way.
That is correct. And one of the great ironies is that the celebration of 100 years of journalism education at LSU comes at the same time that the profession is undergoing such profound change. And we hope next week's activities will bring that juxtaposition together.
Well, there are no journalists better known than Woodward and Bernstein, and you have one half of that duo expected next week. Carl Bernstein, that's a prominent guest.
Right. Carl has been an acquaintance largely because he worked for an uncle of mine at the Washington Star many years ago, and called me about 6 months ago to see if I had any of my uncle's papers, because Carl's writing a book about the old Washington Star. And I said I did have an unpublished autobiography. But by the way, Carl, how about coming down for our centennial? And that's how it began.
And lo and behold, Carl Bernstein will be at LSU. And 1972 is when Watergate occurred, June 17th. Your students were born, for the most part, in the early 1990s. Do they have an appreciation for Woodward and Bernstein?
You know, some of them have heard of Watergate. Not too many really know Woodward and Bernstein. That's an interesting dichotomy. They have an appreciation when the story is told, but many of them actually don't know the story.
They don't know the story, and today, if a similar story was erupting, I'm not sure that there would be a Woodward and a Bernstein out there, intrepid reporters on the loose doing things the way they did. The more we have a 24-hour news cycle now, but I'm not sure investigative reporting hasn't been enhanced.
Well, I think investigative reporting has been enhanced because many, many people can now be investigators. Now, whether they have the journalistic judgment and ethics is another matter, but what they do have is access to big data, as they call it, on the Internet. And it seems to me that citizen journalism is going to contribute a lot. And it has its downside, too.
Well, the technology has certainly changed. Yeah. I don't know of any profession, and John Merrill used to argue that journalism was not a profession, but I don't know of any profession that has been affected more by the technology than journalism.
Yeah, it's really remarkable. And again, the access to information is remarkable. The way we distribute the information is remarkable. The whole thing is quite amazing. And just the variety of sources of news out there is astounding.
We'll talk about some of the activities involving the centennial of the LSU Manship School, and it became the Manship School in the 1980s. It's known to some of us as the J School, but the Manship family has had a big presence at LSU for some time. Jerry Seppos, he served as a Pulitzer Prize juror. He's been around the country working in places like San Jose. You worked in Detroit, didn't you, for a while?
At the Miami Herald, company.
Yeah. Miami, of course, the Miami Herald is recognized as one of the fine journalism entities in the country. The newspaper that exposed Gary Hart many years ago. Were you there then?
I was actually in San Jose then.
And in Nevada, the home of Harry Reid, the Senate Majority Leader, who's been in the news a little bit of late. What do you make of the way that story has been covered? There are people who are criticizing the media for how it has covered this debt issue and default issue. Do you think the media, for the most part, have done a good job, or have they missed the mark?
Well, there's a raging philosophical debate that you just alluded to, and that is there a false equivalency that the press has created by saying, well, both sides are responsible, and should the media be the institution that says, no, actually, it's one side's fault? And it's a complex question. I think most of the mainstream media have done a pretty good job. I do worry a little bit about he said, she said journalism, which is what all of us are taught. And I hope that we're now teaching students to make a few more judgments and to avoid false equivalency. But you can go down a very awkward path there if you're writing opinion when you're supposed to be writing news.
Well, today's headline above the fold, New York Times, GOP can't agree on path to avert default on debt. Now, I don't think there's any doubt that there's a division in the Republican ranks, but some on the right might say that the media, which for better or worse are largely regarded as being more liberal than conservative, are piling on the GOP right now. Is that what's going on, or is the media just trying to report a difficult story?
I think trying to report a difficult story, and this morning I think is one of the easier times, because there were attempts to get the House to act yesterday, and they failed. So I think the Times was correct in saying what it said. As a sidelight, the signature topic for the Manship School at LSU is the intersection of media and public affairs. And given what you just read, I can't think of a more important sort of specialty to have. And we're the only school that teaches media and public affairs at the bachelor's, master's, and doctoral levels.
I don't think there's any school in America, and I speak with some knowledge, but obviously I haven't been to all the schools in America, but the Manship School has tried to blend politics and journalism, and now that dividing line is getting blurrier and blurrier. But the two go together. Certainly in a story like this, you can't report the story without having the context of the politics.
The two go together, and in fact, one of our sequences is called Political Communication, and no other journalism school or mass comm school in America has a track like that. And it was fun during the Romney-Obama campaign to watch two of our alums, one of them cover the Obama campaign or the Romney campaign for Politico,
Ginger
Gibson,
right, who was on this show, yeah,
and another one of our grads was the social media director for the Romney campaign, and I thought, you know, this shows that maybe we're doing something right when sort of both sides of a campaign are being handled by our graduates.
Well, it is interesting that quite often when people talk about media bias, they'll put Fox News on one side and say that it is a conservative bias, and I think it is. And you could probably say MSNBC is the balance on the other side. But instead of MSNBC, you often hear people say you got Fox News on one side and you got the New York Times and National Public Radio on the other side. I don't think that you can equate NPR and the New York Times with Fox News.
I completely agree with you, and many people will also throw in CNN.
They do, yeah.
To that mix of the liberal conspiracy, and I would have to say that I admire CNN and the New York Times and NPR for their straight-ahead coverage, not for political bias. But, you know, all three of them devote, plus Fox, devote a lot of time to politics. And I think some people may equate the amount of time or the fact that you cover a subject like politics with being biased. I don't understand that, but I think there's a confusion in some people's minds.
Well, I think there may even be a need for what Fox is doing and what MSNBC is doing, but people should be aware that they're doing it from a partisan bent.
Correct. And in fact, the Riley family of Baton Rouge has endowed a chair in media literacy here that we're going to be filling in the next year or so. And I hope that we can teach not just journalism students, but students from around the university. How do you assess the organizations that we just named? Seems to me that media literacy is one of the things we're lacking in this country.
297-5633 to talk with Jerry Seppus, who is dean of the Manship School of Mass Communication. He's held that position for 2.5 years now, and for the previous 3 years, he was dean professor in the Fred W. Smith Chair in Journalism at the Reynolds School of Journalism at the University of Nevada, Reno. Now, deans at journalism schools, they get down in the weeds on these media issues, but like every other entity, you're out there having to raise money, aren't you? That's a big part of your job.
It sure is, and talking to a lot of my friends around the country, believe it or not, most of us enjoy it because we're proud of our schools. And fundraisers will tell you if you're not proud of your institution, you're not going to raise any money. So it's fun to talk to people like you. Jim, you're one of our grads and a member of our Hall of Fame. So really going around and talking about what our school does, what makes us unique, is a lot of fun, and it often leads to gifts, which is very nice.
Well, there will be 3 new Hall of Famers next week at the Journalism School. Kevin Riley, posthumously. Jay Perkins, who will be on this show Monday, who developed probably more careers in journalism than anybody in the country while he was a professor at LSU for nearly 3 decades. And the third one is we've got Jay Perkins, we've got Kevin Riley, and we've got Dan Bornay, the voice of the Valley, who has been involved in media and in industry, and he's best known as the voice of Tiger Stadium for the past 27 years. Scott and Baker. Scott, good morning. You're on the air with Jerry Seppus.
CNN is, what'd you say, middle of the road?
That's what I asserted, yes, sir.
Yes, sir. Why would they go, let's see, the last I saw was about the one day they said 27 things negative about the Republicans on the Obama plan and 2 things negative with the Democrats. What do you mean middle of the road?
Well, what did they say negative about the
Every
Republicans?
Time they open their mouth, Jim, they say something negative. You ever listen to Piers Morgan?
I do. Now, Piers Morgan is a talk show host. Piers Morgan's not a journalist. He used to be when he was working for Rupert Murdoch, but he's not anymore. He's a talk show host. Now, what I'm doing right now, I would not consider journalism. Now, when I write a column or do something like that, maybe that's journalism. But this is just having a conversation. But there may be other examples. What else are you referring to?
Well, like I said, every time I try not to listen to CNN, but I want to get the other side at times, and that's why I listen to them.
Well, Scott, thank you for calling. And his opinion, by the way, is not unique to Scott. CNN during the Clinton years was called the Clinton News Network.
Right.
I didn't see that, but some people saw it as biased. Your thoughts?
Well, we all bring our own backgrounds and prejudices and favoritisms and ideas to the party, and we all hear things differently. That's one of the great things about the explosion of information is that we can go wherever we want for our news, for our opinion, and so forth. And that means that there are going to be a lot of opinions floating around out there. It also means, as you just said, that something we talked about in my ethics class a lot at LSU. Is that it's hard to tell what's news, what's entertainment. ESPN mm-hmm. was criticized for pulling out of an investigation about concussions and other brain injuries. Well, as my students pointed out, ESPN probably isn't really a news network, so we talked about what it is. Well, it's entertainment, it's sports. Some of my students thought it was an extension of the NFL.
Well, I think it is in this case. In this case. By the way, Piers Morgan, I think he has like 400,000 viewers a night fewer viewers probably than Donna Britt and Andre Morrow have on Channel 9, and I'm sure he's quite pleased that Scott and Baker is watching him. And I do think he's probably a liberal. We'll talk more with Jerry Seppes. This is Jim Engster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Dean Jerry Seppes of the LSU School of Mass Communication is in the house. And we're talking journalism in America, and we'll be talking about the centennial a bit more as we continue our discussion with Jerry Seppes. Aaron on government. Hi, Aaron. You're on the air with Jerry Seppes.
Yeah, I just had a question about mainstream media. I guess you hear so many complaints about mainstream media, mostly from conservatives. So I wonder, you know, what do they consider Fox, and what is mainstream media? Because a lot of people get their news from alternative news sources, the internet, blogs, et cetera. So what do we mean when we say mainstream media these days?
Well, mainstream media is a figure of speech. Are you talking about the group mainstream media or the collective mainstream media?
The collective. I mean,
okay. What is mainstream? Okay. Well, Jerry Seppes, it gets down to what we've talked about on this show before. The media are regarded, rightly or wrongly, as being more liberal than conservative, and that may be the case, although I don't think they're nearly as liberal as people think. But does that affect the coverage? Can you be a conservative and cover a liberal fairly, or a liberal and cover a conservative fairly?
Sure, if you're a professional. And when I think of mainstream media, and the question is a great one, I think of largely professional journalists. Their main goal in life, their company's main goal in life, is to report the news fairly and accurately. So that's what I call mainstream media. And as I said, we all bring biases to the party. And I think the job of good mainstream media is to attempt to filter out those biases. But again, as we discuss in our ethics classes at LSU, one way to solve the problem is to say, listen, you need to know, Mr. Reader or Mrs. Listener, that I went to an anti-abortion rally the other day, and I went as an individual, but I thought you ought to know that. So mm-hmm. It seems to me that attempts to be fair and accurate and then the willingness to disclose any biases add up to the mainstream media at its best.
And all media entities have some pressure to pay bills, and the bills are almost exclusively paid through advertising or underwriting or contributions of some kind, and those don't just come from osmosis, they come from people and businesses. So the media are connected to the community in a tangible way, and most media people are cognizant of the fact that some things are good for business and some things are not so good for business.
True, although it seems to me that another criterion for mainstream media is independence, which probably means different things mm-hmm. to different people. But I would say that independence, and this might be old-fashioned, but I'm going to stick to it, that independence means that advertising doesn't affect news coverage and probably vice versa, and that's the way it should be.
Well, Charles on North Foster, my dear friend, called the other day and asked about my association with Tiger Rag, and I'm the president of Tiger Rag, and our subscribers are, for the most part, big fans of LSU. I'm an alumnus of LSU. I live in this community, but if there's some chicanery going on at LSU that needs to be reported and the story has been locked down solidly, then I have no aversion to doing that, even though it wouldn't be good for business. I think a lot of people would not like that if Tiger Rag or The Advocate or NOLA.com, Baton Rouge Business Report, you name it, some people would not want anything that would affect, the LSU football program to be exposed by a media entity in this community.
Yeah, that's true. And when the Daily Reveille, the student newspaper, does some of its best work investigating athletics or anything else, you hear that. And my answer is that people are relying on the Reveille to cover LSU, and that's what its job is.
I'm going to go to the website, and there are some emails coming in at inkstershow.org. an Inkster show at WRKF.org. The reason, this is from Wade at Louis, the reason the Republicans get such difficult coverage lately is because they keep shooting themselves in the foot in the national arena. That is news and should be reported. I don't know if that's the case, but it's not like both sides haven't been availed of the chance to speak, and that's the way it should be. But sometimes, in order to understand where somebody's coming from, even if they're expressing something reprehensible, they have to have the microphone at some point.
Yeah, absolutely right. And I would say that in addition to having the microphone, the most responsible mainstream media ought to look at what they're saying at the microphone and dissect it and do a little bit of fact-checking.
Here's one from Jason Collier. I feel Rachel Maddow is informed as anyone on television, does a great job investigating and reporting political facts and history. Chris Matthews and Lawrence O'Donnell are experienced and intelligent and offer great insight. Now, Jason writes this, and I respect his point of view, but what if I got an email, which I may in the next few minutes, from a conservative saying, I think Bill O'Reilly and Sean Hannity are on the mark. I suspect one side or the other is going, huh.
I think you're right, and I respect people who sit there and watch the politics shows. My own preference is to have a good journalist like an Anderson Cooper or somebody else pushing Bill O'Reilly or Rachel Maddow about why they think what they think, rather than unfiltered politics coming from politicians.
297-5633 for Dean Jerry Seppos of the Manship School. Alex at LSU. Alex, you're on the air with Jerry Seppos.
Hi, good morning. I was wondering if I just wanted to comment on what we were talking about earlier about MSNBC being more biased towards the left and Fox News towards the right. But I think there's a really important distinction to make because there are several studies by universities that are done annually, and I'm sure you're familiar with them. They rate how informed people who watch different news sources are, how informed they are in terms of international news like Egypt, Iran, Syria, and stuff like the economy and local issues. And consistently each year, people who watch Fox News and get their news source solely from Fox News are consistently misinformed.
All right. He's saying that people who watch Fox News are less informed than those who watch MSNBC. I don't know. What do you think?
I don't know either, and I worry about all those kinds of surveys and so forth. I don't know the answer.
Okay. HB in Denham Springs. Good morning, HB. Please be brief. You're on with Dean Seppos.
This more or less pertains to the current advocate under the new management there. Personally, I get more out of the Baton Rouge Business Report in content than I do the current advocate, and I like the old one better because it covered more of our local metro area news, whereby today it seems to cover more of New Orleans and other things that doesn't even come close to pertaining what we're reading in Baton Rouge or the metro area.
All right.
Well, I'm a news junkie, so I love what's going on right now. I read NOLA.com and the Times-Picayune when I can get it in print, and I have the Advocate home delivered every morning and enjoy reading it. So I'll disagree with you a little bit. I think we are incredibly lucky right now. We're in the only news war in the country, and it seems to me that getting a little bit more New Orleans coverage is okay. And I just think we're very lucky that there's real competition going on here. My friends around the country say you're lucky for two reasons. As a journalism professor, you got a front row seat, but as a news junkie, you're just living it. So I'll disagree a little bit and say that I love the competition that we're lucky enough to be experiencing.
And I would agree with HB that the Business Report does a fine job. I think They do an excellent job, and they've been saluted nationwide for what they do.
Yeah, I agree. Business journalism is one of the things that I'm particularly interested in, and one of the first things I did here was to subscribe. I agree.
Barry in Mid-City. Barry, you're on the air with Dean Seppos.
Yes, another great show, and great to hear Dean speak to us. There are some newspapers around the country that are so-called community papers that do not accept advertising. And I'm wondering what our dean feels about them, because they then believe they're not beholden to any particular point of view since they don't accept ads.
Yeah, actually, I'm not coming up off the top of my head with newspapers in that situation, but there are a bunch of new online news organizations that don't accept advertising. It seems to me that the good news organizations can build a wall between advertising and editorial, and in 35 years of daily newspaper editing, I never felt that I had to say yes to an advertiser on anything, and my bosses would probably tell you that they heard from a lot of advertisers about that and never were influenced either. It seems to me there does need to be a new model as advertising declines. I would see the need for the model because there's not a lot of advertising money out there. I see less need for it because of the point you're making about influence. So I wish that we could come up with another way to get money for news gathering, but I don't know what it is. And I am very worried about the ideas of government subsidies for news organizations.
Have you ever been pressured not to do a story during your career?
Oh, I've certainly been asked not to do stories, but I wouldn't say that I ever felt pressure because I just sort of instinctively knew what the answer ought to be. So, sure, I've had various businesses unhappy with me, but...
What about your bosses?
I mostly worked for people steeped in journalism, so I rarely had the problem, but I know they had pressure put on them sometimes, but they knew the business we were in.
Okay. Here's one from Silas. Do you think the media have been even-handed in coverage of climate change, or do you think more credence than is warranted has been given to climate change deniers?
Boy, that is a favorite subject and illustrates so well a lot of what we're talking about. No, it seems to me that once again, mainstream media, whatever we mean by that, has done a pretty good job. I would be worried, to tell you the truth, if everyone said, no, we're not going to give any coverage whatsoever to the deniers. I think the deniers are wrong, but I think they should get some coverage. And I would have to say the overwhelming sense of the coverage I've gotten is that there is a climate change issue. So in the end, I think it's all worked out okay.
Okay. Now, as mentioned, Carl Bernstein is coming to Baton Rouge next week. And if we're lucky, we'll have him on this show. He's been here once before, but... hopefully we'll have him right here in the same seat where Dean Sepos is. But next week, the three inductees of the Hall of Fame as part of the centennial celebration are Dan Bornay, Jay Perkins, and Kevin Riley. And for anyone who wishes to attend or participate in any of the centennial events, how can they do it, Jerry Sepos?
Real easily, they can go to the Manship 100 website. They can see the activities they're interested in. And rather than filling out the ticket information, since we're so close, I would say drop a note to manship100@lsu.edu and say, hey, I'd like to attend X events. Tell me how to do it, and we'll get right back to you. And if you'd rather talk to a live human being, give me a call at 225-578-9294. I'd love to talk about the Manship School.
Your private number, 578
9294.
Dean Sepos has been at the school for almost 3 years. And how is the school regarded nationwide as far as how it compares with some of the great journalism schools around the country?
I think very well. The last accrediting process, and I've been involved in accrediting journalism schools for more than 20 years since before I became an educator. In the last accrediting process, the school sailed through before I got there, and we'll be up again in a few years. But we were found in compliance on every standard, which is quite exceptional. And I think more and more people, partly because of the centennial, are aware that our signature is that combination of media and public affairs that I talked about, which makes us stand out and be unusual. And if you're not interested in media and public affairs, you might want to go somewhere else. But if you are, it's a pretty special place.
You served as vice president at Knight Ritter for 6 years, 1999 to 2005, then the second largest newspaper publisher in the country. Tell us about Knight Ritter.
Well, Knight Ritter was a fine organization. I was with them for 33 years at the Miami Herald, the San Jose Mercury News, and the corporate office where I got to work with all 32 of our daily newspapers. But lo and behold, shortly after I left, dissident shareholders said, hey, you're not making enough money for us, threatened to take over, and the company was sold to McClatchy Newspapers, another good organization. But it's pretty amazing after 50 years that that a company could face such pressure, but that's how the public markets work. And it's interesting, most of us and some of your callers worry about advertising. I think probably the bigger issue is, should news organizations be publicly held? And what kind of pressure does that put on them? Not in terms of favoritism, but in terms of how much money they should feel that they have to make.
Well, we saw the Boston Globe sold for $70 million after it was acquired for $1.1 billion 20 years ago. That shows you where newspapers have gone. It's a tough business right now, isn't it?
It is a tough business, and in fact, several of us on the faculty have just written a book that's being shipped off to the publishers about the Baton Rouge, New Orleans news war. And notice that I called it a news war. I don't think it's a newspaper war. And I think that the more that newspaper companies think of themselves as news companies, not tied to newsprint, the better off they'll be.
Gage on I-10. Gage, you're on the air with Jerry Seppos. Hi, Gage.
Hi. Yes, sir. You mentioned op-eds earlier, and I was just wondering, what are the professional parameters for op-ed? You also mentioned citizen journalists, and I know with blogs and everything, there's lots of opinions that are not written by professionals that people read and perhaps perceive as a professional op-ed.
Op-eds, by nature, are opinion-oriented. There's no formula for who's an op-ed columnist, is there?
No, there isn't. There is a fuzzy area that's always bothered me a little bit, and that is a lot of newspapers are very proud when they get a big name to, quote, write an op-ed. So, you know, you'll see head of the Russian government appearing in an op-ed in the New York Times. Well, it turns out that it was placed by a public relations agency, and I have to wonder if that means it was written by a public relations agency. So I'm just a little antsy about seeing famous names on op-eds. As far as regular op-ed columnists go, there is no formula. I think what you want is somebody smart, provocative, who can opine quickly on a subject.
Well, so the Putin op-ed in the New York Times, it may not have been written by Vladimir Vladimirovich Putin?
I would bet money that it was not. And my ethics class hasn't dealt with that because I just don't know what the answer is on that one.
So it may not have been written by V.V. Putin. It may have been written by somebody else. It was a well-written piece, though.
Yeah, I'll leave it at that.
297-5633. We'll be back to wrap it up with Dean Jerry Seppos, and we'll hear from the incomparable Tim Muffett, the conductor of the Baton Rouge Symphony. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. A few more minutes with Jerry Seppos. Angel on Essen. Angel, you're on the air with Jerry Seppos.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for taking my call. I wanted to hear your comment on the gentleman earlier said that he counted the amount of times that CNN said something good about one party and good about the other. And my question is, sometimes there's not an equal amount of good things to say about both sides of the story. I just wanted to hear what you have to say about that. I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Well, you're certainly right about that. And again, that leads to that kind of false equivalency that journalists are debating right now. And furthermore, I worry a little bit about deciding based on, you know, one segment on CNN or one story in the New York Times that their coverage is fair or not fair. I teach our kids to look at the full range of coverage before making a judgment like that. So your point's very well taken.
Any parting thoughts as you prepare for a big week?
No, just again, we're blessed with lots of people in the community being interested in what we're doing. And one more time, the information is at the manship100.com website.
I see you brought Ron Gary's book with you today, Professor Gary, who spent many years as a journalism professor at LSU, taught me and many others for over 30 years. He wrote a good book about the Manship School. So hopefully for people who want to get more acquainted, they can read Ron's book and they can call Dean Sepos at 578-9294. Thank you.
Thank you, Jim.
All right. And Tim Muffett, the conductor of the Baton Rouge Symphony since 1999, is getting ready for the start opening night. Good morning.
Good morning, Jim.
Good to see you. And you had a big week last week.
We sure did. That was a very exciting event Friday night, absolutely.
It was a spectacular event, gospel with the symphony in almost a full house, too.
Well, you know, we invented a new wheel with that one, frankly. There have been other orchestras have done gospel programs, but none quite like this, where we looked at every different kind of music that falls under the huge umbrella of what we call gospel. And then to tie it to Louisiana and to the local talent, I mean, it was a remarkable evening musically and a remarkable evening, too, in just the bringing together of the community.
Well, you had some remarkable talent from our community, probably talent that we didn't even know about. Some great voices were on that stage.
Well, that you know, Jim, that was part of the inspiration for this concert was when I came here in this job in 1999, I began to notice that in the world of gospel music especially, and I am by no means an expert on it at all, but I became aware of the incredible musical talent that is in all of the area churches and saw this is something that needs to be featured. This is something we need to bring together and celebrate. And so I felt like we achieved that, and hopefully this is a program we will come back to and revisit on an annual basis.
Now, did I get it right? Are you starting your 15th season?
Yeah, how about that?
15 years.
I know, it's just flown by.
You were a young man when you came here.
I was, and I am no longer.
That makes two of us, but you still look young. Must be that Manuel Martinez attire.
Of course, that always helps, doesn't it? Yes.
And certainly your personal life is going well. That's always something to help one's youthful verve.
Absolutely, yes. So,
and the people you work with. Mm-hmm. I know you've always complimented the musicians that are on stage with you.
Well, you know, we are very fortunate in this community to have a remarkable talent pool. And then we also have an organization with a terrific reputation. And many of our musicians travel quite long distances to be a part of the Baton Rouge Symphony. And so we have an interesting makeup of a kind of a core of people who are from this area. And then many people come from Houston and from Mississippi, and even have someone who comes from Oklahoma to play with us, and Texas and Baltimore and kind of all over. We do have a terrific group of talent, and that's why we're able to do what we can do.
And you're constantly on the move here in this community and elsewhere, and I think most folks are aware of your role in Lansing, Michigan. Mm-hmm. You have a substantial role there as well.
Yes, I'm the music director of the Lansing Symphony also, and which is a common situation in my business. Many conductors have multiple posts. Some of them do it over spanning an ocean. I don't know quite how they pull that one off. That's a little bit beyond my comprehension. But there are many ways to find synergies. Mm-hmm. Between two performing arts organizations, we often will share guest artists. Someone that I'll present here in Baton Rouge, I'll also present up in Lansing, and maybe we get a little break on the fee. And just trying to make things work out.
How are the communities different? I'm sure there are some distinctions.
They're quite different. At the on the surface, they look quite similar. They're state capitals, they're medium-sized cities, they're major university homes of major universities. The social fabric is quite... There's a great distinction there in terms of just kind of the level of involvement. I feel like here in Baton Rouge, and looking at Friday night is a good example of an openness of bringing large groups of very different people together for a common cause. I think we're very good at that down here.
And Lansing and Baton Rouge have both been places where Nick Saban was employed.
I know. How about that? Yes. I hope that he made those decisions based upon the quality of the performing arts organization.
Does that mean your next stop is Tuscaloosa, Alabama?
No, it does not mean that at all.
Well, tomorrow night, it is tomorrow night, right?
Right.
Wow. The opening of the 65th season for the Baton Rouge Symphony Orchestra. What will we hear and see tomorrow night?
Oh, it's going to be a really exciting program. One of the highlights will be the return of Colton Peltier. And we would say Peltier in down here, but he says Peltier. And Colton played with us last season and just absolutely brought down the house. He's a young man, 19 years old. He came to my attention through Christopher O'Reilly's program From the Top. I know you're familiar with that. Mm-hmm. Last season we had Chris O'Reilly on the season, and then we had one of his proteges from the Top on the season as well. It was kind of a fun setup. But Colton just won the audience over instantly, and so we re-engaged him immediately. And he's playing one of the most popular works for piano and orchestra, the Rachmaninoff Rhapsody on a theme of Paganini. And and rehearsal last night was he just floored me with his playing. It was absolutely magnificent. So we're going to have another big success there.
And the rest of the season?
Well, we have a lot of exciting stuff. Some I'll tell you one interesting collaboration is we're going to partner with the Acadiana Symphony from Lafayette and going to do the Symphony No. 2 of Gustav Mahler, which is, of course, one of these massive epic works that require hundreds of players to perform. So we're going to put our two orchestras together, our two choruses together, and we will rehearse and perform in Baton Rouge, and then we will go to Lafayette and rehearse and perform in Lafayette.
Oh, that's great.
And so it's a wonderful connection of the communities. It's a way to perform a piece like that puts a strain on any organization just because of the number of musicians that need to be hired. So we're kind of, again, finding a synergy with our neighbors in this event.
I'm reading a review of Tim's work as a conductor from the Los Angeles Times. Muffet made the music move with an irresistible sweep. Was that when we were at the Hollywood Bowl?
That was from Long Beach Symphony. I was a guest conductor of the Long Beach Symphony. Okay. And I've been out there a few times, actually. Yeah. And that was nice. I like that one.
That's a good one. The Orange County Register, a performance of unusual depth. Muffet exuded integrity and passion throughout. What makes a good conductor?
Well, in my mind, in the most simple sense, it's the conductor knows what he or she wants from the music and knows how to get it from the orchestra. That's kind of the basic sense. Then you get into the more perhaps philosophical side of what is it that you want from the orchestra, and that's where there's a great deal of differing opinions, but effectiveness is really everything, and it's about creating concerts that move the audience and that will, when an audience comes into the concert hall, they leave having a great experience. The conductor has a part in that.
There was a fascinating opinion piece written by Joanne Lippman a few days ago. Is music the key to success? Condoleezza Rice trained to be a concert pianist. Alan Greenspan, former chairman of the Federal Reserve, was a professional clarinet and saxophone player. The hedge fund billionaire Bruce Kovner is a pianist who took classes at Juilliard. Multiple studies link music study to academic achievement. But what is it about serious music training that seems to correlate with outsized success in other fields? It appears that people who have had exposure to music often achieve great success in fields that might not be considered compatible with music, but there's no doubt that there is a correlation. Why do you think that's the case?
Well, we love stories like this that come out, mm-hmm. but we also believe them. You know, I often like to talk about music as a catalyst for creativity. Those who have studied creativity have found that people basically operate in two modes, your fundamental mode of creativity, and then there are bursts of what you might call overdrive creativity, where you are hyper-inspired. And I'd be stepping out of the scientific realm when I make this connection, but I have to believe that powerful artistic experiences are those catalysts that move people into that kind of level of creativity. When one is exposed to a great painting or a great poem or a great novel or a great mm-hmm. symphony, I think it makes us think, how can we translate that into what we do? If we are an executive, how can we take our experience at the symphony on Thursday night? The executive comes on Thursday night, is deeply inspired by Beethoven. Then I would imagine that Friday morning there is a reinvigoration of creativity in that person. I think that music study for young people, which is part of what this article that you're referring to, I think that has a lot to do with the discipline that goes along with music study, that mm-hmm. That people who study music develop a serious routine. And it isn't just classical music either. You know, these great rock and roll guitarists, they practice too.
Oh, yeah.
I remember a great interview with Eddie Van Halen, you know, and he was practicing 8 hours a day. And I'm thinking, okay, there we go. That's why you sound like that. And so it's all kinds of, there's discipline that's associated with music, just like Gladwell's 10,000 hours, you know, and that translates into wherever you go with it. You learn the discipline through music, and then you can apply it to other fields.
Discipline, teamwork.
Absolutely, teamwork, right?
Yeah. All of those things are important in life.
And then there's the payoff that's greater than the sum of the parts, that you may learn the notes of a piece of music, but then as it is translated through your personal human spirit, it comes out as something much greater than the notes, and it comes out as a powerful expression. And this is another thing that can translate into other areas of your work.
And you were exposed to music at what age?
Probably the very beginning of my life. My sister is a musician. She's 10 years older than I am. My mother and father are both amateur musicians. I can't ever remember a time where there wasn't music in the home.
Do you have an appreciation for all kinds of music?
Oh, by all means. Absolutely. My wife and I were just at the Festival Acadien on Saturday. Yeah. But I love it all. And, Duke Ellington had two great quotes. One is, there are two kinds of music, good music and the other kind. And I love that one. And Ellington's other quote was that if it sounds good, it is good.
Mm-hmm.
And there are musics that I might gravitate mm-hmm. to more than others, but any great music I love to hear.
Well, you and I grew up with the Beatles. And
right.
And I've seen quotes from people like Harry Connick who say the Beatles were overrated and limited in talent. I wouldn't say
that. Well, I would have to disagree with that. I'm surprised to hear someone of his... Mm-hmm. I'm surprised to hear him say that.
Well, and then
give us a call, Harry, if you're listening this morning, and let's
well,
chat about
Artie Shaw blasted Harry, before he died, he blasted Harry Connick Jr., saying he was a no-talent. So
right.
it's a matter of perspective. You can't please everybody.
Right. I think
it's like Fox News and MSNBC, right?
I think the Beatles are rather indisputable in their talent. I mean, you look at the level of creativity, and these guys knew classical music too. I mean, Eleanor Rigby, for example, that's a string quartet that's playing along
it
with
is.
Them. And they were very, that was just part of their culture, even that their music was informed by classical music without a doubt, but just the sheer creativity, the variety of music they wrote.
Well, there probably is no music that hasn't been influenced one way or the other by classical
You're absolutely
music.
Right, yes.
Even country,
you bet, because it was there first and was really the foundation.
Who are your favorite artists that, like the Beatles, so-called mainstream
right.
Musicians, singers,
Wow, that's
Do you like Frank Sinatra or Barbara Streisand?
Oh, I love Frank Sinatra, yes. In that realm, Sinatra, Tony Bennett, And I love that style of music, too. Those were remarkable productions and orchestrations, and they were terrific singers. That, you know, I would have a hard time pinpointing anybody in particular, I think.
But you love good voices, great voices.
Yes.
And some pop singers have, like Bob Dylan, he does not have a great voice, a great songwriter.
But he was a great poet. Right. And he uses his voice in a way that brings on its own character. So, you know, you could say the same thing about Bruce Springsteen. Not a great voice, but the whole package, what he's singing about, and then the way he uses that voice turns it into a viable musical instrument.
Well, tomorrow night, Tim Muffett will be on stage with the Baton Rouge Symphony Orchestra, and it'll be quite a opening of the 65th season. I guess you're headed to rehearsal right now.
Absolutely, yeah.
Thank you, Tim.
Thanks for
always
having
good.
Me.
Always good. Let's do it again.
Okay.
And for J.C. Kane, I'm Jim Inkster. Thank you for listening, everybody, and thank you for contributing to WRKF throughout the day. Your contributions are necessary and appreciated. Until tomorrow, stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Inkster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Inkster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.